And in your comfort we rejoiced even more exceedingly for the joy of Titus, because his spirit has been refreshed by all of you. Look again at how he lifts their praises and demonstrates their love, for after saying, "I was pleased that my letter was so influential and that you benefited so much, for I rejoice," he says, "not that you were upset, but that you were upset enough to repent," and after showing his own love, for he says, "Even though I wrote to you, it was not for the sake of the person who did wrong, nor for the sake of the one who was wronged, but to reveal our concern for you." He once again mentions another indication of their goodwill, giving them significant praise and demonstrating the sincerity of their affection. For, in your consolation, he says, "we rejoiced even more because of Titus's joy." And yet this isn't a sign of someone who loves them intensely, being happier for Titus than for them. "Yes," he responds, "it is, for I didn't rejoice as much for his sake as for yours." As a result, he adds the reason, saying, "because all of you refreshed his spirit." He didn't say he, but his spirit. That is his love for you. And how were they refreshed? By everyone. For this, too, is a very high praise. "For if I have boasted about anything to him on your behalf..." It is high praise when the teacher boasted, for he said, "I was not put to shame. I therefore rejoiced, because you showed yourselves to be amended and proved my words by your actions, so that the honor given to me was twofold, first in that you had made progress, next in that I was not found to fall short of the truth." Verse 14. "But as we always spoke to you honestly, so our boasting that I made before Titus was found to be true." Here he hints at something more. "Just as we spoke honestly about all things among you, so also what we said about you to Titus has been confirmed as true." Verse 15. "And his deep affection for you is even greater." What follows celebrates him as deeply consumed with love and devoted to them. And he didn't say his love. Then, so he may not seem to be pandering, he constantly cites the reasons for his affection, so that he may, as I said, avoid the accusation of flattery and further motivate them by making the praise reflect onto them, and by demonstrating that it was they who instilled in him the foundation and start of this immense love. For after saying, "his inward affection is more abundant toward you," he added, "while he remembers the obedience of you all." Now this demonstrates that Titus was thankful to his benefactors, appreciating that he had returned, keeping them all in his heart, and constantly remembers them, and carries them on his lips and in his mind. Also, this gives a higher honor to the Corinthians, recognizing that they touched him so deeply they sent him away. Then he speaks about their obedience too, praising their enthusiasm. That's why he adds these words: "How you received him with fear and trembling, not only with love, but also with extreme honor. Do you see how he attests to a dual virtue in you? That you both loved him as a father and feared him as a leader, without letting fear diminish love, nor letting love weaken fear. He expressed this earlier as well, that you grieve in a godly manner, what earnest diligence it stimulated in you, indeed what fear, indeed what longing." Verse 16. "I'm happy, therefore, that in every aspect I am confident about you. Do you see how he rejoices more for their sake? Because, he says, you have not failed your teacher in any way, nor shown yourselves unworthy of my praise." Therefore, his joy isn't so much for Titus's sake, because of the great honor he received, but more so for their own good behavior. To clarify his point, notice how again he emphasizes the reason. As he said earlier, "If I boasted about anything to him on your behalf, I was not shown to be a liar." Similarly, he says here, "In every aspect I am confident about you. Should I need to reprimand you, I am not afraid of losing your respect. If I need to boast, I do not fear being accused of lying. If I need to praise you for being obedient or loving or zealous, I trust you. I asked you to cut off, and you did. I asked you to receive, and you did. I told Titus that you are wonderful and respectable people who know how to honor teachers. Your actions proved these things as true. And he learned these things about you not so much from my words, but from your actual actions. In fact, when he left, he had fallen in love with you because your behavior exceeded what he had been told. Furthermore, brothers, we want to inform you about God's grace that has been given to the churches of Macedonia. After inspiring them with these commendations, he once again attempts persuasion. The reason he blended commendations with his criticism was to avoid causing resentment by moving directly from criticism to persuasion. Instead, by pleasing their ears first, he could more effectively pave the way for his persuasive argument. He intends to talk about giving to the needy, which is why he preemptively says, "I am glad that in every way I can have confidence in you." His aim with this is to encourage their readiness for the task at hand based on their previous good actions. Rather than directly saying "give to the needy," notice his wisdom in his approach, subtly preparing them for his message. He informs them, "You should know about the generosity that God has given the churches of Macedonia." This is his way of encouraging them not to become arrogant by labeling their actions as grace. By sharing the commendable actions of others, he ignites a healthy competition amongst them. He notes three praiseworthy aspects of the Macedonians: their resilience during trials, their capacity for empathy, and their generosity in giving to the needy despite their own poverty, as even their own possessions had been seized. When he addressed them in his letter, he refers to this resilience, stating, "For you became imitators of the churches of God that are in Judea, for you too suffered the same things from your own countrymen, just as they did from the Jews." Observe what he then wrote to the Hebrews, "For you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property." But he labels their commendable actions as grace, aiming to not simply keep them humble, but to also kindle a competitive spirit and to avoid causing offense. He incorporates the title brethren to further diffuse potential envy, because he is about to shower them with high praises. Pay attention to his accolades. After stating, "I make known to you the grace of God," he doesn't single out any particular city. Instead, he praises the entire nation by saying, "in the churches of Macedonia." Then he goes on to detail this grace:
"How that in much evidence of suffering, the abundance of their joy." Do you see his wisdom? He doesn't immediately state what he wants, but first introduces another topic. His intention is not to seem too deliberate, but to make his point through different connections. "In much proof of affliction," he said this in his letter to the Macedonians themselves, "you emulated the Lord, receiving his word, despite facing great affliction, but with joy from the Holy Spirit." And again, "the word of the Lord resonated from you, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but also everywhere else. Your faith in God has been acknowledged." But what does "in much proof of affliction, the abundance of their joy" mean? He says that they've experienced both extremes, great affliction and great joy. It's quite remarkable that they could find such intense pleasure amidst their suffering. In fact, their affliction is not a source of sorrow, but it even brings them joy, and this, despite their immense suffering. He states this to encourage them to be strong and resilient during their trials. They were not merely suffering, but also demonstrated their fortitude and patience, or as he says, even exceeding that, joy. However, he didn't merely mention joy, but abundance of joy, as it emerged within them, immense and indescribable.
"And their extreme poverty overflowed in the wealth of their generosity." Again, both these in excess, for as their great affliction led to great joy, indeed abundance of joy, so their extreme poverty led to great wealth of charity. He showed this when he said, "abounded to the wealth of their generosity." For generosity is not determined by the size of the gift, but by the mindset of those who give it. Therefore, he never states the richness of the gifts, but the riches of their generosity. Now, what he's effectively saying is, their poverty didn't only stop them from being generous, but it even led them to be more abundant, just as affliction led to feeling joy. For the poorer they were, the more generous they were, and contributed even more eagerly. Hence, he praises them highly, for despite such great poverty, they demonstrated such great generosity. For their deep, that is, their significant and unspeakable, poverty demonstrated their generosity. But he didn't say demonstrated, but abounded. And he didn't say generosity, but riches of generosity, that is, equaling the magnitude of their poverty, or rather significantly exceeding it, was the generosity they displayed. Then he further clarifies this, saying,
Verse 3, "For within their capabilities I can testify."
The testimony is reliable and beyond their capabilities. That is, it exceeded to the wealth of their generosity. Or more accurately, he clarifies this not only through this phrase, but by everything else that follows. For he says, voluntarily. Look, here's another exceptional instance.
Verse 4, with much pleading, look, yet a third and a fourth, begging us, look, even a fifth. And when they were in distress and in poverty, here are a sixth and seventh, and they gave with excessiveness. Then, since this is what he especially wishes to promote in the Corinthians case, namely the deliberate giving, he emphasizes it, stating, with much pleading and begging us. We did not beg them, but they begged us. Begged us for what? That the grace and fellowship in the service to the saints. Do you see how he uplifts the act, calling it by respectable names? For since they were aspiring for spiritual gifts, he refers to it as grace to encourage their pursuit, and again as fellowship to teach them that they receive, not only give. This is what they pled with us for, he says, that we would undertake such a service.
Verse 5. And this, not as we expected. He says this both in relation to the quantity and their sufferings. For we could never have expected, he says, that while in such severe suffering and poverty, they would have even pressed us and so greatly pleaded with us. He also highlighted their cautiousness in life in other aspects by saying, but first they dedicated themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. For in everything their obedience exceeded our expectations, not just because they showed mercy, but they didn't neglect other virtues either, but first gave themselves to the Lord. What does it mean to give themselves to the Lord? They voluntarily committed themselves, demonstrated their faithfulness, exhibited great endurance during trials, orderliness, kindness, love, and in all matters both readiness and enthusiasm. What does it mean? And to us? They were easily guided, loved us, obeyed us, both adhering to God's laws and bound to us by love. And notice how here again he reveals their determination, saying, gave themselves to the Lord. They did not obey God in some things and the world in others, but in all matters Him, and committed themselves entirely to God. For neither because they showed mercy were they overwhelmed with pointless arrogance, but showing much humility, obedience, respect, and heavenly wisdom, they also practiced their charity in this way. But what does it mean, by the will of God? Since He had said they gave themselves to us, it was not to us in the conventional human way, but they also did this in alignment with God's intent.
Verse 6, so much so that we encourage Titus, that as he had started before, he would also complete this grace in you as well.